The man was tall and gaunt, as haggard as his auditor himself. A thin black beard covered half of his face, and one could see only two black hollows where the eyes were. He was speaking rapidly in great excitement. He used many gestures. As he spoke, he moved here and there upon the stage, reaching with his long arms as if to seize each person in his audience. His voice was deep, like an organ. It was some time, however, before Jurgis thought of the voice. He was too much occupied with his eyes to think of what the man was saying, but suddenly it seemed as if the speaker had begun pointing straight at him, as if he had signaled him out particularly for his remarks, and so Jurgis became suddenly aware of the voice, trembling, vibrant with emotion, with pain and longing, with a burden of things unutterable, not to be compassed by words. To hear it was to be suddenly arrested, to be gripped, transfixed. "You listen to these things," the man was saying, "and you say, 'Yes, they are true, but they have been that way always.' Or you say, 'Maybe it will come, but not in my time. It will not help me.' And so you return to your daily round of toil. You go back to be ground up for profits in the worldwide mill of economic might, to toil long hours for another's advantage, to live in mean and squalid homes, to work in dangerous and unhealthful places, to wrestle with the specters of hunger and privation, to take your chances of accident, disease, and death. And each day the struggle becomes fiercer, the pace more cruel. Each day you have to toil a little harder and feel the iron hand of circumstance close upon you a little tighter. Months pass, years maybe, and then you come again. And again I am here to plead with you, to know if want and misery have yet done their work with you, if injustice and oppression have yet opened your eyes. I shall still be waiting. There is nothing else that I can do. There is no wilderness where I can hide from these things. There is no haven where I can escape them. Though I travel to the ends of the earth, I find the same accursed system. I find that all the fair and noble impulses of humanity, the dreams of poets, and the agonies of martyrs, are shackled and bound in the service of organized and predatory greed. And therefore I cannot rest. I cannot be silent. Therefore I cast aside comfort and happiness, health and good repute, and go out into the world and cry out the pain of my spirit. Therefore I am not to be silenced by poverty and sickness, not by hatred and obloquy, by threats and ridicule, not by prison and persecution if they should come, not by any power that is upon the earth or above the earth, that was or is or ever can be created. If I fail tonight, I can only try tomorrow, knowing that the fault must be mine, that if once the vision of my soul were spoken upon earth, if once the anguish of its defeat were uttered in human speech, it would break the stoutest barriers of prejudice. It would shake the most sluggish soul to action. It would abash the most cynical. It would terrify the most selfish. And the voice of mockery would be silenced, and fraud and falsehood would slink back into their dens, and the truth would stand forth alone. For I speak with the voice of the millions who are voiceless, of them that are oppressed and have no comforter, of the disinherited of life, for whom there is no respite and no deliverance, to whom the world is a prison, a dungeon of torture, a tomb. With the voice of the little child who toils tonight in a southern cotton mill, staggering with exhaustion, numb with agony, and knowing no hope but the grave. Of the mother who sews by candlelight in her tenement garret, weary and weeping, smitten with the mortal hunger of her babes. Of the man who lies upon a bed of rags, wrestling in his last sickness and leaving his loved ones to perish. Of the young girl who somewhere at this moment is walking the streets of this horrible city, beaten and starving, and making her choice between the brothel and the lake. with the voice of those, whoever and wherever they may be, who are caught beneath the wheels of the juggernaut of greed, with the voice of humanity calling for deliverance, of the everlasting soul of man arising from the dust, breaking its way out of its prison, rending the bands of oppression and ignorance, groping its way to the light. The speaker paused. There was an instant of silence while men caught their breaths, and then, like a single sound, there came a cry from 1,000 people. Through it all, Jurgis sat still, motionless and rigid, his eyes fixed upon the speaker. He was trembling, smitten with wonder. Suddenly the man raised his hands, and silence fell, and he began again. "I plead with you," he said, "whoever you may be, provided that you care about the truth. But most of all, I plead with working men, with those to whom the evils I portray are not mere matters of sentiment, to be dallied and toyed with, and then perhaps put aside and forgotten, to whom they are the grim and relentless realities of the daily grind, the chains upon the limbs, the lash upon their backs, the iron in their souls. To you, working men, to you, the toilers, who have made this land and have no voice in its councils. To you, whose lot it is to sow that others may reap, to labor and obey, to ask no more than the wages of a beast of burden. The food and shelter to keep you alive from day to day, it is to you that I come with my message of salvation. It is to you that I appeal. I know how much it is to ask of you. I know, for I have been in your place. I have lived your life. And there is no man before me here tonight who knows it better. I have known what it is to be a street waif, a bootblack, living upon a crust of bread and sleeping in cellar stairways and under empty wagons. I have known what it is to dare and to aspire, to dream mighty dreams and to see them perish. To see all the fair flowers of my spirit trampled into the mire by the wild beast powers of life. I know what is the price that a working man pays for knowledge. I have paid for it with food and sleep, with agony of body and mind, with health, almost with life itself. And so when I come to you with a story of hope and freedom, with a vision of a new earth to be created, of a new labor to be dared, I am not surprised that I find you sordid and material, sluggish and incredulous. That I do not despair is because I know also the forces that are driving behind you, because I know the raging lash of poverty, the sting of contempt and mastership, the insolence of office and the spurns. Because I feel sure that in the crowd that has come to me tonight, no matter how many may be dull and heedless, no matter how many may have come out of idle curiosity or in order to ridicule, there will be some one man whom pain and suffering have made desperate, whom some chance vision of wrong and horror has startled and shocked into attention, and to him my words will come like a sudden flash of lightning to one who travels in darkness, revealing the way before him, the perils and the obstacles, solving all problems, making all difficulties clear. The scales will fall from his eyes, the shackles will be torn from his limbs. He will leap up with a cry of thankfulness, he will stride forth a free man at last, a man delivered from his self-created slavery, a man who will never more be trapped, whom no blandishments will cajole, whom no threats will frighten, who from tonight on will move forward and not backward, who will study and understand, who will gird on his sword and take his place in the army of his comrades and brothers, who will carry the good tidings to others as I have carried them to him, the priceless gift of liberty and light that is neither mine nor his, but is the heritage of the soul of man. Working men. Working men, comrades, open your eyes and look about you. You have lived so long in the toil and heat that your senses are dulled, your souls are numbed. But realize once in your lives this world in which you dwell. Tear off the rags of its customs and conventions. Behold it as it is, in all its hideous nakedness. Realize it. Realize it. Realize that out upon the plains of Manchuria tonight, two hostile armies are facing each other. That now, while we are seated here, a million human beings may be hurled at each other's throats, striving with the fury of maniacs to tear each other to pieces. And this, in the 20th century, 1900 years since the Prince of Peace was born on Earth, 1900 years that his words have been preached as divine, and here two armies of men are rending and tearing each other like the wild beasts of the forest. Philosophers have reasoned, prophets have denounced, poets have wept and pleaded, and still this hideous monster roams at large. We have schools and colleges, newspapers and books. We have searched the heavens and the earth. We have weighed and probed and reasoned, and all to equip men to destroy each other. We call it war and pass it by. But do not put me off with platitudes and conventions. Come with me. Come with me. Realize it. See the bodies of men pierced by bullets, blown into pieces by bursting shells. Hear the crunching of the bayonet plunged into human flesh. Hear the groans and shrieks of agony. See the faces of men crazed by pain, turned into fiends by fury and hate. Put your hand upon that piece of flesh. It is hot and quivering. Just now, it was a part of a man. This blood is still steaming. It was driven by a human heart. Almighty God, and this goes on. It is systematic, organized, premeditated, and we know it, and read of it, and take it for granted. Our papers tell of it, and the presses are not stopped. Our churches know of it, and do not close their doors. The people behold it, and do not rise up in horror and revolution. Or perhaps Manchuria is too far away for you. Come home with me, then. Come here to Chicago. Here in this city tonight, 10,000 women are shut up in foul pens and driven by hunger to sell their bodies to live. And we know it. We make it a jest. And these women are made in the image of your mothers. They may be your sisters, your daughters. The child whom you left at home tonight, whose laughing eyes will greet you in the morning, that fate may be waiting for her. Tonight in Chicago, there are 10,000 men, homeless and wretched, willing to work and begging for a chance, yet starving and fronting in terror the awful winter cold. Tonight in Chicago, there are 100,000 children wearing out their strength and blasting their lives in the effort to earn their bread. There are 100,000 mothers who are living in misery and squalor, struggling to earn enough to feed their little ones. There are 100,000 old people cast off and helpless waiting for death to take them from their torments. There are 1 million people, men and women and children, who share the curse of the wage slave, who toil every hour they can stand and see for just enough to keep them alive, who are condemned till the end of their days to monotony and weariness, to hunger and misery, to heat and cold, to dirt and disease, to ignorance and drunkenness and vice. And then turn over the page with me and gaze upon the other side of the picture. There are 1,000, 10,000 maybe, who are the masters of these slaves, who own their toil. They do nothing to earn what they receive. They do not even have to ask for it. It comes to them of itself. Their only care is to dispose of it. They live in palaces. They riot in luxury and extravagance, such as no words can describe, as makes the imagination reel and stagger, makes the soul grow sick and faint. They spend hundreds of dollars for a pair of shoes, a handkerchief, a garter. They spend millions for horses and automobiles and yachts, for palaces and banquets, for little shiny stones with which to deck their bodies. Their life is a contest among themselves for supremacy in ostentation and recklessness, in the destroying of useful and necessary things, in the wasting of the labor and the lives of their fellow creatures, the toil and anguish of the nations, the sweat and tears and blood of the human race. It is all theirs. It comes to them, just as all the springs pour into streamlets, and the streamlets into rivers, and the rivers into the ocean. So automatically and inevitably all the wealth of society comes to them. The farmer tills the soil, the miner digs in the earth, the weaver tends the loom, the mason carves the stone. The clever man invents, the shrewd man directs, the wise man studies, the inspired man sings. And all the result, the products of the labor of pain and muscle, are gathered into one stupendous stream and poured into their laps. The whole of society is in their grip. The whole labor of the world lies at their mercy. And like fierce wolves, they rend and destroy. Like ravening vultures, they devour and tear. The whole power of mankind belongs to them, forever and beyond recall. Do what it can, strive as it will, humanity lives for them and dies for them. They own, not merely, the labor of society. They have bought the governments. And everywhere they use their raped and stolen power to entrench themselves in their privileges, to dig wider and deeper the channels through which the river of profits flow to them. And you, working men, you have been brought up to it. You plod on like beasts of burden, thinking only of the day and its pain. Yet is there a man among you who can believe that such a system will continue forever? Is there a man here in this audience tonight so hardened and debased that he dare rise up before me and say that he believes it can continue forever? That the product of the labor of society, the means of existence of the human race, will always belong to idlers and parasites, to be spent for the gratification of vanity and lust, to be spent for any purpose whatever, to be at the disposal of any individual will whatever, that somehow, somewhen, the labor of humanity will not belong to humanity, to be used for the purposes of humanity, to be controlled by the will of humanity. And if this is ever to be, how is it to be? What power is there that will bring it about? Will it be the task of your masters, do you think? Will they write the charter of your liberties? Will they forge you the sword of your deliverance? Will they marshal you the army and lead it to the fray? Will their wealth be spent for the purpose? Will they build colleges and churches to teach you? Will they print papers to herald your progress and organize political parties to guide and carry on the struggle? Can you not see that the task is your task? Yours to dream, yours to resolve, yours to execute. That if ever it is carried out, it will be in the face of every obstacle that wealth and mastership can oppose, in the face of ridicule and slander, of hatred and persecution, of the bludgeon and the jail. That it will be by the power of your naked bosoms, opposed to the rage of oppression, by the grim and bitter teaching of blind and merciless affliction, by the painful gropings of the untutored mind, by the feeble stammerings of the uncultured voice, by the sad and lonely hunger of the spirit, by seeking and striving and yearning, by heartache and despairing, by agony and sweat of blood, it will be by money paid for with hunger, by knowledge stolen from sleep, by thoughts communicated under the shadow of the gallows. It will be a movement beginning in the far-off past, a thing obscure and unhonored, a thing easy to ridicule, easy to despise, a thing unlovely, wearing the aspect of vengeance and hate. But to you, the working man, the wage slave, calling with a voice insistent, imperious, with a voice that you cannot escape, wherever upon the earth you may be, with the voice of all your wrongs, with the voice of all your desires, with the voice of your duty and your hope, of everything in the world that is worthwhile to you, the voice of the poor demanding that poverty shall cease, the voice of the oppressed pronouncing the doom of oppression, The voice of power, wrought out of suffering, of resolution, crushed out of weakness, of joy and courage, born in the bottomless pit of anguish and despair. The voice of labor, despised and outraged, a mighty giant, lying prostrate, mountainous, colossal but blinded, bound and ignorant of his strength. And now a dream of resistance haunts him, hope battling with fear, until suddenly he stirs, and a fetter snaps, and a thrill shoots through him to the farthest ends of his huge body, and in a flash the dream becomes an act. He starts, he lifts himself up, and the bands are shattered, the burdens roll off him. He rises, towering, gigantic, he springs to his feet, he shouts in his newborn exultation. As the speaker's voice broke suddenly, with the stress of his feelings, he stood with his arms stretched out above him, and the power of his vision seemed to lift him from the floor. The audience came to its feet with a yell. Men waved their arms, laughing aloud in their excitement, and Jurgis was with them. He was shouting to tear his throat, shouting because he could not help it, because the stress of his feeling was more than he could bear. It was not merely the man's words, the torrent of his eloquence. It was his presence. It was his voice, a voice with strange intonations that rang through the chambers of the soul like the clanging of a bell, that gripped the listener like a mighty hand about his body, that shook him and startled him with sudden fright, with the sense of things not of earth, of mysteries never spoken before, of presences of awe and terror. There was an unfolding of vistas before him, a breaking of the ground beneath him, an upheaving, a stirring, a trembling. He felt himself, suddenly, a mere man no longer. There were powers within him undreamed of. There were demon forces contending, age-long wonders struggling to be born, and he sat oppressed with pain and joy, while a tingling stole down his fingertips, and his breath came hard and fast. The sentences of this man were to Jurgis like the crashing of thunder in his soul. A flood of emotion surged up in him. All his old hopes and longings, his old griefs and rages and despairs, all that he had ever felt in his whole life seemed to come back to him at once, and with one new emotion, hardly to be described. That he should have suffered such oppressions and such horrors was bad enough, but that he should have been crushed and beaten by them, that he should have submitted and forgotten and lived in peace, ah, truly that was a thing not to be put into words, a thing not to be borne by a human creature, a thing of terror and madness. What, asks the prophet, is the murder of them that kill the body to the murder of them that kill the soul? And Jurgis was a man whose soul had been murdered, who had ceased to hope and to struggle, who had made terms with degradations and despair, and now, suddenly, in one awful convulsion, the black and hideous fact was made plain to him. There was a falling in of all the pillars of his soul. The sky seemed to split above him. He stood there, with his clenched hands upraised, his eyes bloodshot, and the veins standing out purple in his face, roaring in the voice of a wild beast, frantic, incoherent, maniacal. And when he could shout no more, he still stood there, gasping and whispering hoarsely to himself, "By God! By God! By God!" Chapter 29. The man had gone back to a seat upon the platform, and Jurgis realized that his speech was over. The applause continued for several minutes, and then someone started a song, and the crowd took it up, and the place shook with it. Jurgis had never heard it, and he could not make out the words, but the wild and wonderful spirit of it seized upon him. It was the Marseillaise. As stanza after stanza of it thundered forth, he sat with his hands clasped, trembling in every nerve. He had never been so stirred in his life. It was a miracle that had been wrought in him. He could not think at all. He was stunned. Yet he knew that in the mighty upheaval that had taken place in his soul, a new man had been born. He had been torn out of the jaws of destruction. He had been delivered from the thraldom of despair, The whole world had been changed for him. He was free. He was free. Even if he were to suffer as he had before, even if he were to beg and starve, nothing would be the same to him. He would understand it and bear it. He would no longer be the sport of circumstances. He would be a man, with a will and a purpose. He would have something to fight for, something to die for, if need be. Here were men who would show him and help him. He would have friends and allies. He would dwell in the sight of justice and walk arm in arm with power. The audience subsided again, and Jurgis sat back. The chairman of the meeting came forward and began to speak. His voice sounded thin and futile after the others, and to Jurgis it seemed profanation. Why should anyone else speak after that miraculous man? Why should they not all sit in silence? The chairman was explaining that a collection would now be taken to defray the expenses of the meeting, and for the benefit of the campaign fund of the party. Jurgis heard, but he had not a penny to give, and so his thoughts went elsewhere again. He kept his eyes fixed on the orator, who sat in an armchair, his head leaning on his hand, and his attitude indicating exhaustion. But suddenly he stood up again, and Jurgis heard the chairman of the meeting saying that the speaker would now answer any questions which the audience might care to put to him. The man came forward, and someone, a woman, arose and asked about some opinion the speaker had expressed concerning Tolstoy. Jurgis had never heard of Tolstoy and did not care anything about him. Why should anyone want to ask such questions after an address like that? The thing was not to talk, but to do. The thing was to get hold of others and rouse them, to organize them and prepare for the fight. But still the discussion went on, in ordinary conversational tones, and it brought Jurgis back to the everyday world. A few minutes ago he had felt like seizing the hand of the beautiful lady by his side and kissing it. He had felt like flinging his arms about the neck of the man on the other side of him, and now he began to realize again that he was a hobo, that he was ragged and dirty and smelt bad and had no place to sleep that night. And so at last, when the meeting broke up and the audience started to leave, poor Jurgis was in an agony of uncertainty. He had not thought of leaving. He had thought that the vision must last forever, that he had found comrades and brothers, but now he would go out, and the thing would fade away, and he would never be able to find it again. He sat in his seat, frightened and wondering. But others in the same row wanted to get out, and so he had to stand up and move along. As he was swept down the aisle, he looked from one person to another wistfully. They were all excitedly discussing the address, but there was nobody who offered to discuss it with him. He was near enough to the door to feel the night air when desperation seized him. He knew nothing at all about that speech he had heard, not even the name of the orator. And he was to go away. No. No, it was preposterous. He must speak to someone. He must find that man himself and tell him. He would not despise him, tramp as he was. So he stepped into an empty row of seats and watched, and when the crowd had thinned out, he started toward the platform. The speaker was gone, but there was a stage door that stood open, with people passing in and out, and no one on guard. Jurgis summoned up his courage and went in and down a hallway into the door of a room where many people were crowded. No one paid any attention to him, and he pushed in, and in a corner he saw the man he sought. The orator sat in a chair with his shoulders sunk together and his eyes half closed. His face was ghastly pale, almost greenish in hue, and one arm lay limp at his side. A big man with spectacles on stood near him and kept pushing back the crowd, saying, "Stand away a little, please. Can't you see the comrade's worn out?" So Jurgis stood watching while 5 or 10 minutes passed. Now and then the man would look up and address a word or two to those who were near him, and at last, on one of these occasions, his glance rested on Jurgis. There seemed to be a slight hint of inquiry about it, and a sudden impulse seized the other. He stepped forward. "I wanted to thank you, sir," he began in breathless haste. "I could not go away without telling you how much how glad I am I heard you. I didn't know anything about it at all." The big man with the spectacles, who had moved away, came back at this moment. "The comrade's too tired to talk to anyone," he began, but the other held up his hand. "Wait," he said. "He has something to say to me." And then he looked into Jurgis's face. "You want to know more about socialism?" he asked. Jurgis stared. He stammered. "Is it socialism?" I didn't know. I want to know about what you spoke of. I want to help. I have been through all that. Where do you live? Asked the other. I have no home, said Jurgis. I am out of work. You are a foreigner, are you not? Lithuanian, sir. The man thought for a moment, and then turned to his friend. Who is there, Walters? He asked. There's Ostrinsky, but he's a Pole. Ostrinsky speaks Lithuanian, said the other. All right, then, would you mind seeing if he's gone yet? The other started away, and the speaker looked at Jurgis again. He had deep black eyes and a face full of gentleness and pain. You must excuse me, comrade, he said. I'm just tired out. I've spoken every day for the last month. I will introduce you to someone who will be able to help you as well as I could. The messenger had to go no further than the door. He came back, followed by a man whom he introduced to Jurgis as Comrade Ostrinsky. Comrade Ostrinsky was a little man, scarcely up to Jurgis's shoulder, wizened and wrinkled, very ugly and slightly lame. He had on a long-tailed black coat worn green at the seams and the buttonholes. His eyes must have been weak, for he wore green spectacles that gave him a grotesque appearance. But his hand clasp was hearty, and he spoke in Lithuanian, which warmed Jurgis to him. You want to know about socialism? He said. Surely, let us go out and take a stroll where we can be quiet and talk some. And so Jurgis bade farewell to the master wizard and went out. Ostrinsky asked where he lived, offering to walk in that direction, and so he had to explain once more that he was without a home. At the other's request, he told his story, how he had come to America and what had happened to him in the stockyards, and how his family had been broken up, and how he had become a wanderer. So much the little man heard, and then he pressed Jurgis's arm tightly. You have been through the mill, comrade, he said. We will make a fighter out of you. Then Ostrinsky in turn explained his circumstances. He would have asked Jurgis to his home, but he had only two rooms and had no bed to offer. He would have given up his own bed, but his wife was ill. Later on, when he understood that otherwise Jurgis would have to sleep in a hallway, he offered him his kitchen floor, a chance which the other was only too glad to accept. Perhaps tomorrow we can do better, said Ostrinsky. We try not to let a comrade starve. Ostrinsky's home was in the ghetto district, where he had two rooms in the basement of a tenement. There was a baby crying as they entered, and he closed the door leading into the bedroom. He had three young children, he explained, and a baby had just come. He drew up two chairs near the kitchen stove, adding that Jurgis must excuse the disorder of the place, since at such a time one's domestic arrangements were upset. Half of the kitchen was given up to a workbench, which was piled with clothing, and Ostrinsky explained that he was a pants finisher. He brought great bundles of clothing here to his home, where he and his wife worked on them. He made a living at it, but it was getting harder all the time, because his eyes were failing. What would come when they gave out, he could not tell. There had been no saving anything. A man could barely keep alive by 12 or 14 hours' work a day. The finishing of pants did not take much skill, and anybody could learn it, and so the pay was forever getting less. That was the competitive wage system, and if Jurgis wanted to understand what socialism was, it was there he had best begin. The workers were dependent upon a job to exist from day to day, and so they bid against each other, and no man could get more than the lowest man would consent to work for. And thus, the mass of the people were always in a life-and-death struggle with poverty. That was competition, so far as it concerned the wage earner, the man who had only his labor to sell. To those on top, the exploiters, it appeared very differently, of course. There were few of them, and they could combine and dominate, and their power would be unbreakable. And so all over the world, two classes were forming, with an unbridged chasm between them. The capitalist class, with its enormous fortunes, and the proletariat, bound into slavery by unseen chains. The latter were 1,000 to 1 in numbers, but they were ignorant and helpless, and they would remain at the mercy of their exploiters until they were organized, until they had become class-conscious. It was a slow and weary process, but it would go on. It was like the movement of a glacier. Once it was started, it could never be stopped. Every socialist did his share and lived upon the vision of the good coming, when the working class should go to the polls and seize the powers of government, and put an end to private property and the means of production. No matter how poor a man was, or how much he suffered, he could never be really unhappy while he knew of that future. Even if he did not live to see it himself, his children would, and to a socialist, the victory of his class was his victory. Also, he had always the progress to encourage him. Here in Chicago, for instance, the movement was growing by leaps and bounds. Chicago was the industrial center of the country, and nowhere else were the unions so strong. But their organizations did the workers little good, for the employers were organized also, and so the strikes generally failed, and as fast as the unions were broken up, the men were coming over to the socialists. Ostudensky explained the organization of the party, the machinery by which the proletariat was educating itself. There were locals in every big city and town, and they were being organized rapidly in the smaller places. A local had anywhere from 6 to 1,000 members, and there were 1,400 of them in all, with a total of about 25,000 members, who paid dues to support the organization. Local Cook County, as the city organization was called, had 80 branch locals, and it alone was spending several thousand dollars in the campaign. It published a weekly in English, and one each in Bohemian and German. Also, there was a monthly published in Chicago, and a cooperative publishing house that issued 1.5 million of socialist books and pamphlets every year. All this was the growth of the last few years. There had been almost nothing of it when Ostudensky first came to Chicago. Ostudensky was a Pole, about 50 years of age. He had lived in Silesia, a member of a despised and persecuted race, and had taken part in the proletarian movement in the early 70s, when Bismarck, having conquered France, had turned his policy of blood and iron upon the international. Ostudensky himself had twice been in jail, but he had been young then and had not cared. He had had more of his share of the fight, though, for just when socialism had broken all its barriers and become the great political force of the empire, he had come to America and begun all over again. In America, everyone had laughed at the mere idea of socialism then. In America, all men were free, as if political liberty made wage slavery any the more tolerable, said Ostudensky. The little tailor sat tilted back in his stiff kitchen chair with his feet stretched out upon the empty stove, and speaking in low whispers so as not to waken those in the next room. To Jurgis he seemed a scarcely less wonderful person than the speaker at the meeting. He was poor, the lowest of the low, hunger-driven and miserable, and yet how much he knew, how much he had dared and achieved, what a hero he had been. There were others like him, too, thousands like him, and all of them working men. That all this wonderful machinery of progress had been created by his fellows, Jurgis could not believe it. It seemed too good to be true. That was always the way, said Ostudensky. When a man was first converted to socialism, he was like a crazy person. He could not understand how others could fail to see it, and he expected to convert all the world the first week. After a while, he would realize how hard a task it was, and then it would be fortunate that other new hands kept coming, to save him from settling down into a rut. Just now, Jurgis would have plenty of chance to vent his excitement, for a presidential campaign was on, and everybody was talking politics. Ostudensky would take him to the next meeting of the branch local and introduce him, and he might join the party. The dues were 5 cents a week, but anyone who could not afford this might be excused from paying. The Socialist Party was a really democratic political organization. It was controlled, absolutely, by its own membership, and had no bosses. All of these things, Ostudensky explained, as also the principles of the party. You might say that there was really but one socialist principle, that of no compromise, which was the essence of the proletarian movement all over the world. When a socialist was elected to office, he voted with old party legislators for any measure that was likely to be of help to the working class. But he never forgot that these concessions, whatever they might be, were trifles compared with the great purpose, the organizing of the working class for the revolution. So far, the rule in America had been that one socialist made another socialist once every 2 years. And if they should maintain the same rate, they would carry the country in 1912, though not all of them expected to succeed as quickly as that. The socialists were organized in every civilized nation. It was an international political party, said Ostrinsky, the greatest the world had ever known. It numbered 30 millions of adherents, and it cast 8 million votes. It had started its first newspaper in Japan and elected its first deputy in Argentina. In France, it named members of cabinets, and in Italy and Australia, it held the balance of power and turned out ministries. In Germany, where its vote was more than a third of the total vote of the empire, all other parties and powers had united to fight it. It would not do, Ostrinsky explained, for the proletariat of one nation to achieve the victory, for that nation would be crushed by the military power of the others. And so the socialist movement was a world movement, an organization of all mankind to establish liberty and fraternity. It was the new religion of humanity. Or you might say it was the fulfillment of the old religion, since it implied but the literal application of all the teachings of Christ. Until long after midnight, Jurgis sat lost in the conversation of his new acquaintance. It was a most wonderful experience to him, an almost supernatural experience. It was like encountering an inhabitant of the fourth dimension of space, a being who is free from all one's own limitations. For 4 years now, Jurgis had been wandering and blundering in the depths of a wilderness, and here suddenly a hand reached down and seized him and lifted him out of it and set him upon a mountaintop from which he could survey it all. He could see the paths from which he had wandered, the morasses into which he had stumbled, the hiding places of the beasts of prey that had fallen upon him. There were his Packingtown experiences, for instance. What was there about Packingtown that Ostrinsky could not explain? To Jurgis, the Packers had been equivalent to fate. Ostrinsky showed him that they were the Beef Trust. They were a gigantic combination of capital, which had crushed all opposition and overthrown the laws of the land and was preying upon the people. Jurgis recollected how, when he had first come to Packingtown, he had stood and watched the hog killing and thought how cruel and savage it was, and come away congratulating himself that he was not a hog. Now his new acquaintance showed him that a hog was just what he had been, one of the Packers' hogs. What they wanted from a hog was all the profits that could be got out of him, and that was what they wanted from the working man, and also that was what they wanted from the public. What the hog thought of it and what he suffered were not considered, and no more was it with labor and no more with the purchaser of meat. That was true everywhere in the world, but it was especially true in Packingtown. There seemed to be something about the work of slaughtering that tended to ruthlessness and ferocity. It was literally the fact that in the methods of the Packers, 100 human lives did not balance a penny of profit. When Jurgis had made himself familiar with the socialist literature, as he would very quickly, he would get glimpses of the Beef Trust from all sorts of aspects, and he would find it everywhere the same. It was the incarnation of blind and insensate greed. It was a monster devouring with 1,000 mouths, trampling with 1,000 hoofs. It was the great butcher. It was the spirit of capitalism made flesh. Upon the ocean of commerce it sailed as a pirate ship. It had hoisted the black flag and declared war upon civilization. Bribery and corruption were its everyday methods. In Chicago, the city government was simply one of its branch offices. It stole billions of gallons of city water openly. It dictated to the courts the sentences of disorderly strikers. It forbade the mayor to enforce the building laws against it. In the national capital, it had power to prevent inspection of its product and to falsify government reports. It violated the rebate laws, and when an investigation was threatened, it burned its books and sent its criminal agents out of the country. In the commercial world, it was a juggernaut car. It wiped out thousands of businesses every year. It drove men to madness and suicide. It had forced the price of cattle so low as to destroy the stock-raising industry, an occupation upon which whole states existed. It had ruined thousands of butchers who had refused to handle its products. It divided the country into districts and fixed the price of meat in all of them. And it owned all the refrigerator cars and levied an enormous tribute upon all poultry and eggs and fruit and vegetables. With millions of dollars a week that poured in upon it, it was reaching out for the control of other interests, railroads and trolley lines, gas and electric light franchises. It already owned the leather and the grain business of the country. The people were tremendously stirred up over its encroachments, but nobody had any remedy to suggest. It was the task of socialists to teach and organize them, and prepare them for the time when they were to seize the huge machine called the Beef Trust and use it to produce food for human beings and not to heap up fortunes for a band of pirates. It was long after midnight when Jurgis lay down upon the floor of Ostrinsky's kitchen, and yet it was an hour before he could get to sleep for the glory of that joyful vision of the people of Packingtown marching in and taking possession of the Union stockyards. Chapter 30. Jurgis had breakfast with Ostrinsky and his family, and then he went home to Elzbieta. He was no longer shy about it, and when he went in, instead of saying all the things he had been planning to say, he started to tell Elzbieta about the revolution. At first, she thought, he was out of his mind, and it was hours before she could really feel certain that he was himself. When, however, she had satisfied herself that he was sane upon all subjects except politics, she troubled herself no further about it. Jurgis was destined to find that Elzbieta's armor was absolutely impervious to socialism. Her soul had been baked hard in the fire of adversity, and there was no altering it now. Life to her was the hunt for daily bread, and ideas existed for her only as they bore upon that. All that interested her in regard to this new frenzy which had seized hold of her son-in-law was whether or not it had a tendency to make him sober and industrious, and when she found he intended to look for work and to contribute his share to the family fund, she gave him full rein to convince her of anything. A wonderfully wise little woman was Elzbieta. She could think as quickly as a hunted rabbit, and in half an hour she had chosen her life attitude to the socialist movement. She agreed in everything with Jurgis, except the need of his paying his dues, and she would even go to a meeting with him now and then and sit and plan her next day's dinner amid the storm. For a week after he became a convert, Jurgis continued to wander about all day looking for work, until at last he met with a strange fortune. He was passing one of Chicago's innumerable small hotels, and after some hesitation he concluded to go in. A man he took for the proprietor was standing in the lobby, and he went up to him and tackled him for a job. "What can you do?" the man asked.
"Anything, sir," said Jurgis, and added quickly, "I've been out of work for a long time, sir. I'm an honest man, and I'm strong and willing." The other was eyeing him narrowly. "Do you drink?" he asked.
"No, sir," said Jurgis.
"Well, I've been employing a man as a reporter, and he drinks. I've discharged him 7 times now, and I've made up my mind that's enough. Would you be a porter?"
"Yes, sir."
"It's hard work. You'll have to clean floors and wash spittoons and fill lamps and handle trunks."
"I'm willing, sir."
"All right. I'll pay 30 a month and board, and you can begin now if you feel like it. You can put on the other fellow's rig." And so Jurgis fell to work and toiled like a Trojan till night. Then he went and told Elzbieta, and also, late as it was, he paid a visit to Ostrinsky to let him know of his good fortune. Here he received a great surprise, for when he was describing the location of the hotel, Ostrinsky interrupted suddenly, "Not Heinz!"
"Yes," said Jurgis, "that's the name."
To which the other replied,
"Then you've got the best boss in Chicago. He's a state organizer of our party and one of our best-known speakers."
So the next morning, Jurgis went to his employer and told him, and the man seized him by the hand and shook it.
"By Jove," he cried, "that lets me out. I didn't sleep all last night because I discharged a good socialist."
So after that, Jurgis was known to his boss as Comrade Jurgis, and in return he was expected to call him Comrade Heinz. Tommy Heinz, as he was known to his inmates, was a squat little man with broad shoulders and a florid face, decorated with gray side whiskers. He was the kindest-hearted man that ever lived, and the liveliest. Inexhaustible in his enthusiasm, and talking socialism all day and all night. He was a great fellow to jolly along a crowd, and would keep a meeting in an uproar. When once he got really waked up, the torrent of his eloquence could be compared with nothing save Niagara. Tommy Hines had begun life as a blacksmith's helper and had run away to join the Union Army, where he had made his first acquaintance with graft in the shape of rotten muskets and shoddy blankets. To a musket that broke in a crisis, he always attributed the death of his only brother, and upon worthless blankets he blamed all the agonies of his own old age. Whenever it rained, the rheumatism would get into his joints, and then he would screw up his face and mutter, "Capitalism, my boy, capitalism! Écrasé l'infâme!" He had one unfailing remedy for all the evils of this world, and he preached it to everyone, no matter whether the person's trouble was failure in business, or dyspepsia, or a quarrelsome mother-in-law. A twinkle would come into his eyes, and he would say, "You know what to do about it. Vote the socialist ticket." Tommy Hines had set out upon the trail of the octopus as soon as the war was over. He had gone into business and found himself in competition with the fortunes of those who had been stealing while he had been fighting. The city government was in their hands, and the railroads were in league with them, and honest business was driven to the wall, and so Hines had put all his savings into Chicago real estate and set out single-handed to dam the river of graft. He had been a reform member of the city council. He had been a greenbacker, a labor unionist, a populist, a Bryanite, and after 30 years of fighting, the year 1896 had served to convince him that the power of concentrated wealth could never be controlled, but could only be destroyed. He had published a pamphlet about it and set out to organize a party of his own when a stray socialist leaflet had revealed to him that others had been ahead of him. Now for 8 years, he had been fighting for the party anywhere, everywhere, whether it was a GAR reunion or a hotel keeper's convention or an Afro-American businessman's banquet or a Bible society picnic. Tommy Hines would manage to get himself invited to explain the relations of socialism to the subject in hand. After that, he would start off upon a tour of his own, ending at some place between New York and Oregon, and when he came back from there, he would go out to organize new locals for the state committee, and finally, he would come home to rest and talk socialism in Chicago. Hines Hotel was a very hotbed of the propaganda. All the employees were party men, and if they were not when they came, they were quite certain to be before they went away. The proprietor would get into a discussion with someone in the lobby, and as the conversation grew animated, others would gather about to listen, until finally everyone in the place would be crowded into a group, and a regular debate would be underway. This went on every night. When Tommy Hines was not there to do it, his clerk did it. And when his clerk was away campaigning, the assistant attended to it, while Mrs. Hines sat behind the desk and did the work. The clerk was an old crony of the proprietor's, an awkward, raw-boned giant of a man with a lean, sallow face, a broad mouth, and whiskers under his chin, the very type and body of a prairie farmer. He had been that all his life. He had fought the railroads in Kansas for 50 years, a granger, a farmer's alliance man, a middle-of-the-road populist. Finally, Tommy Hines had revealed to him the wonderful idea of using the trusts instead of destroying them, and he had sold his farm and come to Chicago. That was Amos Struver. And then there was Harry Adams, the assistant clerk, a pale, scholarly-looking man who came from Massachusetts, of Pilgrim stock. Adams had been a cotton operative in Fall River, and the continued depression in the industry had worn him and his family out, and he had emigrated to South Carolina. In Massachusetts, the percentage of white illiteracy is 0.8%, while in South Carolina, it is 13.6%. Also in South Carolina, there is a property qualification for voters, and for these and other reasons, child labor is the rule. And so the cotton mills were driving those of Massachusetts out of the business. Adams did not know this. He only knew that the southern mills were running, but when he got there, he found that if he was to live, all his family would have to work, and from 6 o'clock at night to 6 o'clock in the morning. So he had set to work to organize the mill hands after the fashion in Massachusetts, and had been discharged. But he had gotten other work and stuck at it, and at last there had been a strike for shorter hours, and Harry Adams had attempted to address a street meeting, which was the end of him. In the states of the far south, the labor of convicts is leased to contractors. And when there are not convicts enough, they have to be supplied. Harry Adams was sent up by a judge who was a cousin of the mill owner, with whose business he had interfered, and though the life had nearly killed him, he had been wise enough not to murmur, and at the end of his term he and his family had left the state of South Carolina, Hell's Backyard, as he called it. He had no money for car fare, but it was harvest time, and they walked one day and worked the next, and so Adams got at last to Chicago and joined the Socialist Party. He was a studious man, reserved, and nothing of an orator, but he always had a pile of books under his desk in the hotel, and articles from his pen were beginning to attract attention in the party press. Contrary to what one would have expected, all this radicalism did not hurt the hotel business. The radicals flocked to it, and the commercial travelers all found it diverting. Of late, also, the hotel had become a favorite stopping place for Western cattlemen. Now that the beef trust had adopted the trick of raising prices to induce enormous shipments of cattle and then dropping them again and scooping in all they needed, a stock raiser was very apt to find himself in Chicago without money enough to pay his freight bill, and so he had to go to a cheap hotel, and it was no drawback to him if there was an agitator talking in the lobby. These Western fellows were just meat for Tommy Hines. He would get a dozen of them around him and paint little pictures of the system. Of course, it was not a week before he had heard Jurgis's story, and after that, he would not have let his new porter go for the world. "See here," he would say in the middle of an argument, "I've got a fellow right here in my place who's worked there and seen every bit of it." And then Jurgis would drop his work, whatever it was, and come, and the other would say, "Comrade Jurgis, just tell these gentlemen what you saw on the killing beds." At first, this request caused poor Jurgis the most acute agony, and it was like pulling teeth to get him to talk, but gradually he found out what was wanted, and in the end he learned to stand up and speak his piece with enthusiasm. His employer would sit by and encourage him with exclamations and shakes of the head. When Jurgis would give the formula for potted ham, or tell about the condemned hogs that were dropped into the destructors at the top and immediately taken out again at the bottom to be shipped into another state and made into lard, Tommy Hines would bang his knee and cry, "Do you think a man could make up a thing like that out of his head?" And then the hotel keeper would go on to show how the socialists had the only real remedy for such evils, how they alone meant business with the beef trust. And when, in answer to this, the victim would say that the whole country was getting stirred up, that the newspapers were full of denunciations of it, and the government taking action against it, Tommy Hines had a knockout blow already. "Yes," he would say, "all that is true, but what do you suppose is the reason for it? Are you foolish enough to believe that it's done for the public? There are other trusts in the country just as illegal and extortionate as the beef trust. There's the coal trust that freezes the poor in winter. There's the steel trust that doubles the price of every nail in your shoes. There's the oil trust that keeps you from reading at night. And why do you suppose it is that all the fury of the press and the government is directed against the beef trust?" And when to this, the victim would reply that there was clamor enough over the oil trust, the other would continue, "10 years ago, Henry D. Lloyd told all the truth about the Standard Oil Company and his wealth versus commonwealth, and the book was allowed to die, and you hardly ever hear of it. And now, at last, two magazines have the courage to tackle Standard Oil again. And what happens? The newspapers ridicule the authors, the churches defend the criminals, and the government does nothing. And now, why is it all so different with the beef trust?" Here the other would generally admit that he was stuck, and Tommy Hines would explain to him, and it was fun to see his eyes open, "If you were a socialist," the hotel keeper would say, "you would understand that the power which really governs the United States today is the railroad trust. It is the railroad trust that runs your state government wherever you live and that runs the United States Senate. And all of the trusts that I have named are railroad trusts, save only the beef trust. The beef trust has defied the railroads. It is plundering them day by day through the private car. And so the public is roused to fury, and the papers clamor for action, and the government goes on the war path.
And you poor common people watch and applaud the job and think it's all done for you and never dream that it is really the grand climax of the century-long battle of commercial competition, the final death grapple between the chiefs of the Beef Trust and Standard Oil for the prize of the mastery and ownership of the United States of America.
Such was the new home in which Jurgis lived and worked, and in which his education was completed. Perhaps you would imagine that he did not do much work there, but that would be a great mistake. He would have cut off one hand for Tommy Hines, and to keep Hines's hotel a thing of beauty was his joy in life. That he had a score of socialist arguments chasing through his brain in the meantime did not interfere with this. On the contrary, Jurgis scrubbed the spittoons and polished the banisters all the more vehemently, because at the same time he was wrestling inwardly with an imaginary recalcitrant. It would be pleasant to record that he swore off drinking immediately, and all the rest of his bad habits with it, but that would hardly be exact. These revolutionists were not angels. They were men, and men who had come up from the social pit, and with the mire of it smeared over them. Some of them drank, and some of them swore, and some of them ate pie.